if we want to overcome the darkness in our lives, the darkness that creeps in, the things that we struggle with, the things that are hard for us, we have to be willing to do something, to change something, to try something different.
And I'm convinced that the human spirit was not designed to simply maintain normal. Somewhere along the line, we forget that our job wasn't to maintain normal. Our job was to step into an unprecedented future where God continually presses us into what's next.
God will never ask you to respond to a call that doesn't already speak to the best part of you, the part of you that was designed for greatness, that deep down knows that there is something more.
Hey, and welcome to the Humanity Church Podcast. I hope that you enjoy this week's talk and want to invite you to join us live at 10 a.m. at the Glasshouse Concert Hall in beautiful downtown Pomona. Or you can join the conversation at www.humanitychurch.com. You can also download the Humanity Church app on iTunes or Android and keep up with the conversation and community there. If you would like to financially support this podcast and the ongoing work at Humanity, you can text the one word Humanity Church to 77977 or check out the giving option on the app. Enjoy this week's talk.
Hey, we are starting a brand new series this week called Presence. And as we enter into this conversation, really our heart was to create a season and a space where we would really connect to the presence of God. And we would teach one another what that looks like, engage in what that looks like, and explore moments in the scriptures where people experience the presence of God and what that transform into action and real life for them. And it's interesting because today, as we launched this series, there was all kinds of issues and we couldn't get the LED wall working. Our kids director had to go to the hospital. I mean, all this stuff. And I'm not one to be like, the devil's at work. But it's kind of interesting that the day we launch a series called The Presence of God, that everything goes haywire. Because I think there is something that the presence of darkness, I'll just call it that, that doesn't want us to experience this presence of God. Because the second we get about that, everything starts shifting. So I want to actually start this series in just a moment of prayer. A prayer of God moving in us and through us, but then also covering us in a space where we can really connect to His voice and His presence and His movement. So would you just join me in that moment right now? Jesus, we thank you that you are present with us and that you are near and that you are close and that you move in us and through us and around us, Father. And as we enter into this season of examining and searching and practicing your presence, God, would you come and would you fill us, first of all? Would you be near and would you be real and would you be tangible and relevant to who we are and what we're up to and what you're up to, God? But would you also cover us? Would you create a space where we could be free from the distractions that come when we attempt to connect to your voice and your presence? And we will pursue with everything that we have because we know that you're pursuing with everything that you have. And so we're grateful. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. I've had a lot of weird jobs over the years, a lot of weird jobs. My first job was cleaning typewriters in the Pomona City Hall at age 11. And every summer, my dad said, you can either find a job or I will find you a job. And he usually found me a job. It was very weird. But I realized early on, I need to find my own jobs. And so I realized if I'm going to find my own jobs, I want to find a job that I enjoy at a very early age. So at age 13, I auditioned to be on-air talent for the Children's Broadcasting Corporation. And I got the job. I actually worked on their radio station for about 3 years as a DJ. And one of my jobs was to go to exciting places like Disneyland and Universal Studios as a kid and interview celebrities every Saturday. That was my gig as a kid, which was pretty awesome. And it was always fascinating because I wouldn't know who I was interviewing probably until a week beforehand. And it was very secretive and not too many people got to know, and they started advertising days before. But I remember there was a handful of times where we would get big name celebrities at the last minute that would be coming in. And in the 1990s, these were like big names. Anyone remember Jonathan Taylor Thomas?
Yes.
Some of you girls still have like the Tiger Beat magazine, right? JTT.
Yes.
Macaulay Culkin, right after Home Alone came out, and some other celebrities like that. But I remember getting really nervous because I had all these ideas about what this individual was like and what these personalities were going to be like. And I had all these ideas from a distance of what they were like. I had all these images from movies and from television shows and from other interviews that I had seen them do. But it was always fascinating when I got in their presence how everything shifted. Because most of them were really socially awkward. I mean, just really weird to be around and didn't really know how to connect because they had grown up on a movie set. And you tried to engage them in conversation and they were like a super weird homeschooler. Not that homeschoolers are weird, but you know what I'm talking about. But it was one of those things, right? And it was always interesting to have this moment where who you imagined this person to be was juxtaposed with this experience of who they were. That when you got in their presence, everything shifted about what you thought about them, what you knew about them. It was a whole different ball game once you started connecting to their personality and their presence and what they brought with that. And in the same way, I feel like that's how it is with God. That we have an idea about who God's like. In fact, it's always interesting to me, one of the exercises that I'll have groups do at times is draw a picture of God. And it's amazing how all the pictures are dramatically different. Because we all have an image of what God looks like. For some of us, it's like an old man with a beard in heaven sitting on a cloud somewhere. For some of us, it's more like the smoke monster from Lost. For some of us, it's just like a dove or a presence that's there. We all have different images of what God looks like. And then we connect to God's presence, if you've ever had that experience, and everything shifts, everything changes. It's a whole different ballgame when you're actually connecting to an individual, to the spirit and the presence of God, rather than the idea of who God is. And I have 3 degrees in theology, and I can tell you that all the theology in the world of studying books about who God is does not prepare you to encounter the presence of God, to connect with who he is. And see, the fact of the matter is that most of our faith, most of our religious systems, they are more informed by the Reformation than they are the Renaissance. And if you know anything about history, the Reformation was a period in human history that was all about knowledge. That if we got enough knowledge in our system, then we could connect to some larger conversation. In fact, our faith is much more informed by Schoolhouse Rock that knowledge is power, right? Which is oftentimes like when people talk about going deep in their spirituality, it involves like studying ancient languages and getting out all these books that have dust on them and looking at maps and concordances and lexicons and really engaging a depth that has more to do with knowledge than it has to do with presence. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the thing is that when you're connecting to spirituality, spirituality is primarily connected to relationship. It's primarily about connecting to a someone. So when it comes to relationship, knowledge is a gateway to a connection, but knowledge is not the end game. See, it would be really weird if I met Marla and I was like, hey, good to meet you. Why don't you hang out over there? I'm just going to research. I'm going to get your bio. I'm going to get your Facebook. I'm going to do some interviews. We don't really need to hang out. I'm just going to get all the information that I need to know about you and call that relationship. That would be weird. We call that stalking, right? And the fact of the matter is that's how most of us at times relate to our connection to God. That if we get enough knowledge, if we get enough information, if we get enough data, then somehow we will connect to him in a powerful way. Now, knowledge is important. Like, it's important for me to know if I'm going to love my wife that I should never bake her a lemon-flavored dessert because she will not eat it, right? That's a helpful piece of knowledge if I'm going to connect to her at that level. But that is only helpful if I'm interested in connecting to her presence and to who she is and what she's up to. And we have asked the question for years, does God exist? Which is a very, like, scientific question. It is really driven by knowledge because you can answer that question using the scientific method of hey, let's put a hypothesis out there and let's test it out and see if it's possible. And for years and years and years, Christians have been attempting to prove that question to non-Christians. And the fact of the matter is, I think we're addressing the wrong question. Because does God exist is actually not that compelling of a question to answer. See, because lots of people know that their fathers exist, but if they're not present in their lives, it doesn't actually matter. Wow. See, some of you actually have fathers that you know are out there somewhere, but because they've been absent, you know that that knowledge actually makes things worse than helpful. And so from the beginning of time, people have not been asking the question, does God exist? They've been asking the question, how do I connect to his presence? How do I connect to him in a meaningful way? Isn't it interesting that in every single culture, there is some attempt to manifest a presence of a divinity? Whether it's lighting candles or chanting or seances or sacrifices or meditation or burning incense, there's all these practices that people attempt to connect to a divine, to connect to the beyond. It's interesting that in anthropological studies, when people go out into remote places in the world and they find tribes that have never been connected to the outside world, they have yet to find an atheist tribe. Strange enough, right? That every single culture on the planet that has not even had contact with the organized religious world has some type of system to connect to a presence beyond what they can see, feel, and touch, because it's almost as if our souls were designed to long for presence, to long for something bigger than ourselves. So the question isn't, does God exist? The question is, how do we connect to him if he does exist? How do we connect to him in a way that transforms our experience here and now? What is he like? What difference does it make in our lives here and now? And how can we connect to him in a way that transforms things? And probably one person in the scripture understood this more than most, and his name was David. He was this unique combination of a warrior, poet, king, who desperately longed for the presence of God. And he connected the presence of God to almost every area of his life, his economics, his social world, his status with human beings. And so in Psalms 84, he writes this. So turn with me if you have a copy of the scriptures to Psalms 84. If you need a Bible, you don't have one, you can raise your hand and we'd love to get you one. We'd love to let you have that. It can be yours. You can have it forever. And this is what David writes in Psalms 84 about the presence of God. He says, "How lovely is your dwelling place, Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found a home and the swallow a nest for herself where she may have her young, a place near your altar, Lord Almighty, my God and my King. Blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of spring. The autumn rain covers it with pools. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. Hear my prayer, Lord Almighty. Listen to me, God of Jacob. Look on our shield, O God. Look with favor on your anointed one. Better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord bestows favor and honor. No good thing does he withhold from those whose walk is blameless. Lord Almighty, blessed is the one whose trust is in you." See, this is David expressing how much his soul longs to connect to this presence of a God who sustains him. When we were moving from our loft into this facility and then getting this facility ready, Leslie, myself, Marla, others, Claudia, John, I can see a handful of people in here. We're here long hours of the day, just preparing things. And I found myself waking up in the middle of the night thinking of all the things that needed to get done that day. Have you ever done that? Then you can't go back to bed because now all you're thinking about is the thing that you need to do at 6 a.m. So we were here really early. I would be up at 5 and sometimes I'd be here by 7 getting things ready over there or prepping things here. And we would just start working. We'd get in and hit the ground running and go, go, go. And have you ever started working so hard that you forget like basic human needs and functions? See, what would happen is that in the middle of all this movement, in the middle of all this heavy, intensive labor, whether it was painting or moving objects or getting things in place, time would roll on. It would get to be 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and I started recognizing that around 3:45, I hadn't eaten anything all day. Ever been there before? And suddenly I'm like, why all of a sudden do I feel like I need to pass out, right? And I would immediately stop everything we're doing. Like, we have to eat right now because we had been doing so much work and had not had any intake in the middle of all the work that was around us. And see, there are these internal needs that we all have, like food and oxygen and water, that we need at a very visceral level. And if you just ignore them, you will definitely find yourself in a place of with a lack of health rather quickly. I mean, if you don't believe that, just stop breathing and say, I don't need that right now, right? You will quickly find out how much you actually need oxygen. Stop drinking water and you'll find out how quickly you actually need water. Stop eating, you'll quickly find how much you need food. But what happens at times is we ignore those internal longings and all of a sudden we find ourselves ready to pass out because we don't have what we need to sustain the life here and now. And what David understood was that our souls operate a lot like our physical body. That we are in a constant craving for something beyond ourselves, something bigger than ourselves that would satisfy these needs. And I love the language that he uses because he actually sounds like my two-year-old when he uses this language. Jackson uses really exaggerative language. I'm starving, I'm dying, I'm tired. I don't know where he got that from, but that's what language he uses, right? But I love that because there's just this guttural, intrinsic, I need this. And he doesn't have a lot of ways to express it, but he finds the most extreme language, extreme attitude, extreme expression to express his innate desires inside of him. And David uses this exact same language to get the point across. I long for you. I am fainting for you. I cry out for you. There's something raw about David's connection to the presence of God because he recognizes that there is this raw connection that he has to sustain himself in the middle of all that he is going through. See, when I look at my life and the life of so many other people, I recognize this very raw, like gut-level longing for something bigger than us, for something that will satisfy the needs that are there. We are longing for something that will quiet all of the anxiety, all of the fear, all of the apathy, all of the restlessness, all of the longing, the fainting, the crying. See, you can attempt to quench that thirst with a lot of things. But until you actually find what your soul is longing for, you will just keep exacerbating the problem. I worked also at a summer camp 2 years in a row. And my apartment that I lived in up in Running Springs, California, was right next to the infirmary. So I got to see a lot of broken legs and vomiting and all kinds of things that were going on through summer camp. And one of the things that we constantly told the kids who were junior high, high school age, was you have to drink water up here. It's high elevation, lots of sun. You get dehydrated really quickly. And inevitably, every day, kids would come in dehydrated, 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 dehydrated. And I remember this one kid came in severely dehydrated one day. In fact, we had to rush him to the hospital. And he was insisting that he had been drinking all day long. And he was just like certain about it. We're like, dude, you are literally about to go to the hospital. Can you just tell us what's been going on? He's like, no, I've been drinking all day long. And we finally said, what have you been drinking? And he said, I've had like 16 Mountain Dews. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is what went wrong right here, right? Not only are you dehydrated, now you have diabetes, right? Because he had been longing to quench this internal craving for water, for something that would satisfy his basic intrinsic needs and was using the wrong substance. And for some of us, we don't actually recognize that internal craving for something bigger than ourselves, for a presence that will satisfy our needs. And when we fail to recognize it, it becomes lethal to us. It becomes a lethal experience. But for some of us, we actually recognize it, but then we attempt to quench it with everything else besides the presence that we are actually longing for. See, when our souls are longing for his presence, that's the only thing that will satisfy. And David uses these words. He says, better is one day in your presence than thousands of days elsewhere. Now, I read that and I go, really, David? Like, I don't know. Like 1,000 days in Cancun sounds pretty legit, right? Like even if God was just to come to me and he was like, hey, would you like 1,000 days in Tahiti or one day with me? I would have to think about that for a little while. David seems really certain about this. Like, hey, one day with you would be better than 1,000 elsewhere. I'm like, hey, I'll take 100 in Hawaii, 100 in... I mean, I can think of maybe a lot of places that I'd like to have 1,000 days. Now, I know that David is a poet, and he uses beautifully expressive language, but express this raw reality that he understands here in this moment. Because the presence of God with us is a lot like oxygen. Is that we don't think about it. And yet every single day, we are reliant upon the oxygen that we're breathing. In fact, now you're very aware of your breathing, aren't you? But we just go through our day breathing. We go through our day, we wake up, we don't think about it. At no point am I like, oh good, yeah, it's still working, right? It just keeps going. It's in the background. It's what sustains us constantly. Now, if God came to me and he said, hey, would you rather have 1,000 days in Cancun or breathe? I'd be like, yes, breathing would be the optimal choice there, right? But for some reason, when he comes to us and he says, hey, would you like 1 day with me or 1,000 days and all the other pleasures? We're kind of like, yeah, I don't know about that. See, because we fail to recognize how critical it is that we connect to his presence beyond all things. And here's the thing. It's not like God is sometimes present and sometimes not present. I think sometimes we have this idea that God is suddenly present with us and then he's off doing other things, right? Because it feels like that at times. But the fact of the matter is that God is always present, much like oxygen. He is always with us, always moving, always speaking. The thing is, it's not that God isn't always present, it's that we're not always present. That we're not always presently connected to what God's up to with the reality that's happening around us. And we use language that we put it on God coming and going, but it's actually us who are coming and going. In fact, oftentimes after a worship time, people will say, man, God's presence really fell. And it wasn't like there was just a little bit of presence before that, and then he was like, oh, they're singing to me. Let me go check this out, right? Okay, I'm here now, right? It wasn't like there was less God in this space at 8:45 than there was at 10:15 in the middle of us singing to him. But we have this experience almost as if God suddenly came, or God fell, or God showed up. See, it's not that God fell, or that God showed up, or that he moved. It's that we moved. It's that we showed up. It's that we fell in the middle of all of it. And we became aware that God was actually with us in the middle of everything. And so oftentimes we subscribe on him coming and going. But it's actually us that come and go in and out of his presence and awareness of what he's up to. And there's this moment that I want to look at today in Exodus chapter 33, where Moses has this experience of connecting to the presence of God in such a powerful way. In Exodus 33, it says this. Now, this is right when the Israelites are about to enter into the promised land. They've been wandering in the wilderness for years and years and years, and they are about, like, on the home stretch, about to get there. And they've been a little obstinate along the way. But this is what Moses says to God in the middle of this. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, leave this place and the people you brought up out of Egypt and go to the land I promised an oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I'll send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. So go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people. And I might destroy you on the way. When the people heard these distressing words, quite distressing, right? They began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments, for the Lord had said to Moses, tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you even a moment, I might destroy you. This is the equivalent of like, I will turn this car around, right? And he says, I now take off your ornaments and I will decide what to do with you. So the Israelites stripped off their ornaments at the mountain of Horeb. See, have you ever been so mad that you just had to leave the room? Have you ever found yourself, I am just so mad right now, I have to leave the room. This is like a daily occurrence in our house. Not between me and Marla, between us and our children, right? There are moments where we just know, like, we've actually developed a look now. It's like, oh, Marla, put the child down and leave the room, right? And usually it's more me. Nathan, put the child down and leave the room. Because there are these moments where we just get so overwhelmed with anger that we have to leave this space. And there have been moments that I have had to leave meetings and spaces for fear of what I might do or say. I just need to cool down in that moment. And this was a moment with God's presence. Because he had been wandering with them and wandering with them and wandering with them. And they had the privilege of having his tangible presence with them as they wandered. And they had abused it time after time after time. They had chosen other gods. They had chosen to walk away. They had chosen to do their own thing. And God's finally like, I'm done. I need to leave because I might kill you in the middle of all this. And he says that they are a stiff-necked people, meaning they are a stubborn people. That they were unwilling to bend to the simple request of this. Hey, follow me to the promised land. Right? God, wasn't like asking anything crazy. He wasn't like, dig a hole in the desert, right? He wasn't like, go build me a temple. He was just like, hey, let's go to paradise. And they're like, yeah, not really my thing, but feel free, right? And God's frustrated in this moment. I remember when we started training our dogs early on, our trainer told us that you should never pull your dog when he starts pulling on the leash, because dogs have this natural reflex in them that when they get pulled on, their neck instantly goes stiff. In fact, they will actually pull back on you. And so the more you pull, the more stiff-necked they will become, and it will become completely irrelevant whether or not you are pulling or not. And see, this is the exact same thing that's happening here in this moment. That God was saying, if you would just honor my presence, just connect with it and listen to it and follow me, I have really, really good plans for you. This land of milk and honey, it's coming your way. If you would just connect to my presence. And they were unwilling to connect to it. They had all kinds of ideas about what was better for them and how they could find the promised land on their own and what milk and honey looked like to them. And so they became stiff-necked, stubborn in that moment, unwilling to connect to them, and they failed to recognize their need for the presence of God. And they lost the presence in that moment. See, so often when God connects to us and he starts moving us and informing us of the places he has for us and the dreams he has for us and the longings he has for us, we become stubborn, saying, no, I know you have a good plan, but let me tell you about my plan, right? So let me tell you about all the cool things that I'm going to do. And we become stiff-necked. And so what we do is we put God on a shelf, and then we walk away. And then the second we get in trouble, we start yelling at him. God, where are you? You were supposed to be here. When we screw up our lives, we're like, where did you go? You have left me. Once again, God cannot be trusted. Meanwhile, it wasn't God who left, it was us who left him. And he's wondering, when will you return back to me in the middle of this? We go searching and begging for him when it's us that have left, not him. But what I love in this moment is that even in his anger, he is merciful. Because he says, you know what? I'm going to give you the promised land, but I'm just not going to go with you. So I'm going to keep my word. I'm going to give you everything. I'm going to give you the milk and the honey. It's all yours. But I just have no intention of going with you. See, one of the most dangerous places in this life is when you get everything that you want and nothing that you need. When you actually get the promised land and left behind the promise in the middle of searching for it. See, I wonder for how many of us we have left the presence of God and thought that, well, my own personal pleasure is exactly what I need. As long as I feel good, I'm okay. I wonder for how many of us we've just thought, hey, if I can just get this career in order and get all my 401k together and make sure that I'm taken care of, then life will be wonderful. The strange thing is that we get there and then we're still left unhappy. In fact, studies shown that the cap for happiness with money is about $60,000. So some of you may be there, some of you may get there, all right? But it's even shown that it's not like, hey, once I get to $100,000, I'll be happy. It actually leaves us even more empty. For some of us, we just think, hey, if I get the perfect family together, if we're just tight and close and everything's working together, then life will be peaceful and I'll have everything that I long for. And crazily enough, you can have everything that you wanted and still be left empty in the middle of this. But he hears the cries of his people, and it actually appears that he shifts in the middle of it. That when the people are finally willing to connect authentically to the presence of God, it seems like it shifts the atmosphere with and for God, because the story continues with this in verse 7. It says, now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. Anyone acquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp, and whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrance to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. So Moses went into the tent. The pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke to Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshiped, each at the entrance to their tent, and the Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide, Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. And Moses said to the Lord, you have been telling me, lead these people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, I know you by name, and you have found favor with me. If you are pleased with me, teach me your ways so that I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people. And the Lord replied, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Then Moses said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? And the Lord said to Moses, I will do the very thing you have asked because I am pleased with you and I know you by name. See, Moses went out to this tent of meeting that he sent up where God met with him in this place. And all through the journey towards the promised land, God would establish these physical locations where he would meet with his people. During the day, he said it was like this giant pillar of cloud, and at night, it was this giant pillar of fire. But it would be this place where God would actually physically meet with his people. And it says that Moses set up this tent, private tent, outside of the camp there. And it says that he would talk to God as one talks to a friend. I don't know what that means. And I don't know what that looks like. And I don't care what theologian you talk to, they don't know what that looks like either. But I do know that I want that. Yeah. And I do know that almost every single human being on the planet would love to have that happen as well. Yeah. I mean, even if you're an atheist in this room, wouldn't it be cool if God did exist? You could just have a chat, right? Face to face, just shoot the breeze as one talks to a friend about the intimate, important things about him. And this is the beautiful thing that God longs to have with us and for us. See, for some of us, not only is our idea of God and presence connected more by the Reformation, but it's also connected much more by the Old Testament. Because when you ask kids, where is God? They usually point to the sky, right? Where is God? Somewhere out there in the middle of nowhere. See, before this in the Old Testament, they had a tabernacle where God would move with them from the tabernacle to tabernacle to tabernacle. And then, once they got more situated, they built this temple where God would come and he would fill the temple. And that's where his presence would be. And strangely enough, God is actually no longer in a temple, but we assume that he is still. And we relate to him as if that's the case. I had this weird realization this morning that when we moved into this building, I have had to do so much language correction, even with our leaders, because we moved into this building, and all of a sudden, this room became the sanctuary. And I kept saying, I don't understand why you keep calling this the sanctuary. You know, the strange thing is that when we were at the glass house, no one called the glass house the sanctuary. That's right. Never had that problem. Because, of course, God wouldn't live there. In a grungy warehouse. But stained glass windows, he'd probably live here, right? I mean, a 130-year-old building, clearly a sanctuary, right? Isn't it interesting how our theology hasn't shifted from the Old Testament? That we still assume that this is where God chooses to reside. As if all the places that God could be, he would be in an old building in the middle of Pomona. See, we actually still think that God is connected to a location. But this was only his idea for a moment in time so that he could connect to his people in that space, in that time. See, but God was actually frustrated when he had to live in a sanctuary. He was actually not okay with having to live in a sanctuary. It was much too confining for him. He kept thinking, this is not okay because I have to keep talking to Moses through like a veil or a cloud or prophets. And then it was through a tent, and then it was through everything else. And he never, ever wanted it that way. See, most of the Old Testament is God attempting to get closer to humanity, and humanity attempting to get further and further away from him. But when God sends Jesus into human history, it is this. It is God's declaration saying, this is enough. I can no longer live with this type of relating to my people. This type of presence does not work for me. Because what I'm actually interested in is an intimate, connected relationship with the people that I have created. And I am no longer interested in having a relationship through priests or smoke or veils or angels or prophets or fire. I want to be intimate, like a friend is with another friend connected in this tent of meeting. I want to be as close as possible to you. I want you to know my presence as intimate as you know your spouse or your children or the people around you. See, it was the sacrifice of Jesus and his resurrection that created a space for the presence to no longer have to live in a sanctuary, but it entered into a sanctuary. Where he could connect with us intimately. And no longer is there need for a building or a tent or a tabernacle or a temple, that your soul now becomes the tent of meeting with God. And that God's presence gets to connect with you here so that you can be like Moses, intimate as friends, because friends are intimate with each other's hearts. They know the details of what's going on together. And I love that Moses goes into this tent of meeting and he tells God, not moving. God tells him, move on. I'm gonna give you the promised land. My presence is just not going with him. And I love Moses' obstinance. He's like, yeah, not going. Right? I don't know about you, but if I'm in God's presence, no way am I saying nope. But I love Moses here, and he says, teach me your ways, and please remember that these are your people. Because what Moses understood was that to move forward in life without the presence of God was pointless. That to move forward without connecting to that, it was pointless. That he would rather live in a desert with the presence of God than enter into the promised land without him. See, when we understand that it's the presence of God that our souls long for, anything else, including the promised land, seems insignificant compared to what we have in him. See, because Moses understood this really critical reality that without the presence, he would be diminished to common. In fact, that verse in Exodus 33 is my life verse. I love when he says, what will distinguish me and your people from all of the other people on the planet if we don't have your presence? He's essentially saying, we would be just like everyone else. We would be common. See, because holy is what happens when we connect to God. And we oftentimes think that evil is the opposite of holy, but it is not. Common is the opposite of holy. Ordinary, mundane, predictable is the opposite of holy. See, I actually wish that more Christians would be horrified with the idea of a common life than the threat of hell. I actually wish that we would be so scared out of our minds that we might actually live a common life here and now, than someday suffer eternal torment, that this would be a much more compelling motivator than someday being punished for a life not connected to God. See, when you were designed to live in the uncommon, the holy, the presence, nothing else will satisfy. And when you fail to live there, you've simply missed your potential because you've missed the presence. You've missed the friendship with God that moves you to this place. And Moses says, I am not moving till you move because your presence is too critical. It's life. See, he's saying, I want to elevate your life. See, what would happen when you get to a place in life when you tell God, I am not moving until you move? I refuse to move forward with my family the way it is until your presence moves. I refuse to move forward in this mess of my finances until your presence moves. I refuse to move forward with my mental health until your presence moves. I refuse to move forward with my children and with my career and with all of these dreams that I have until your presence moves. See, and God responds to Moses' stiff-necked ways. See, if you're going to be stubborn in life, at least be stubborn for the things that are going to move you towards health. That's what I love about Moses, is Moses was equally stiff-necked, but he was stiff-necked for the things that would move him towards life. He was like, yeah, not moving, stiff-necked, right? And so God responds in such a stiff-necked way. He says, all right, I'll do what you ask. I have known you by name. See, this is how intimate that God is with you, that he knows you by name. There is something powerful in this. See, it's interesting where spirituality is headed, because So many people don't like the idea of God being a him and a person, like an entity that we get to connect with. Yes, God's presence is everywhere. God's presence is in the trees, and it's in the water, and it's in the wind, and it's in the person sitting next to you. But there is a person named Jesus that his presence connects with. And we connect with, when we connect to that presence, everything else shifts around us. And look, I don't know if we move God's mind or not, but Moses did.
Right.
So there's something to say about that, right? That Moses was so obstinate for the things of God that God was like, clear, got it, I'll go with you, right? I will move. And see, this is the relationship that I long for my own life and my family's life and for our community, that we would be so obstinate for the things of God, that we would be so stiff-necked for the things of God, that God would say, those people are stubborn, man. They are not moving, literally. So I must move because of their love and submission towards me in the middle of this. And then Moses does something incredibly risky. At the end of this conversation, in verse 18, it says, then Moses says, now, show me your glory.
Yeah.
And the Lord says, I will cause my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. And then the Lord said, there is a place nearby where you may stand on a rock. When my presence goes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock and will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. And then I will remove my hand and you will see my face, my back, but my face cannot be seen. Have you ever found yourself in that place where your parents were in such a good mood that you asked them for the big thing? You're like, oh, they're in a good mood. Hey, can I have the keys, right? Hey, things are going really well. Could I get a 20, right? I feel like this is where Moses was. He's like, okay, God just changed his mind. Let's try for the big thing, right? And he asked for the big thing. He says, I want to see you. I want to see you in all of your glory. I want to know the fullness of the God that I am in intimate relationship with you. See, Moses was so desperate for the fullness of the intimacy of the presence of God that he knew it, that it would be worth pursuing, that it was the one thing worth pursuing in this moment. And I love that God says, yes, I will show you my glory, but you can't see all of it. Because if you saw all of it, you would be so overwhelmed that you might die. I mean, this is how big the presence of God is. But I love this statement. He says, I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. See, the horrible thing is that the Christian world has taken that phrase and turned it into a phrase of exclusivity. That somehow God chooses people and then he doesn't choose other people. That somehow God is for people and that he's not for other people. Well, God will have compassion on who he has compassion. But see, the crazy thing is that whenever God makes this statement, I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion, it is an inclusive statement. See, because he is making it about a people that should have not experienced his compassion, that had no merit to experience the compassion of God. And what he is saying to Moses and what he is saying to people is, look, you really have not earned this, and you don't deserve this. But guess what? I have compassion on who I choose to have compassion on. And I always choose the outsider. I choose the one who is undeserving. I choose the one who is disconnected. I choose the one who has done nothing to earn my favor, but I choose them anyway, which is good news for you and I. Because I know for me and I know for so many people that the one thing that is the barrier to God's presence is this idea that somehow I have not earned it. And guess what? You never will.
Yeah, right.
You never will. But this is the beautiful thing about God, is that when you start pursuing him in the same fashion that he has been pursuing you since before you were born, he turns to you with compassion and says, I will have compassion on who I will have compassion. There is nothing else you need to do. See, I have no idea what it looked like for Moses to see the backside of God. But this is what happens. And if you read on, it actually says that he left that place, and his face was glowing so bright that they actually had to put a blanket on him because it was so bright. That he was just beaming. He was radiant with the presence of God. But I love that above all of the miracle of it, like the passing in a rock and all this stuff, that Moses was like, I don't care about any of that. I just want to know your presence, whatever it takes. You need to hide me in a rock, put your hand over it, great. I just need a bit. And it changed everything. He longed to see him and know him and experience him and to be with him, to know his glory. See, some of you may have actually moved on in this life. And you lost the presence of God somewhere along the way. Maybe this temptation of worry and anxiety was way more attractive than just simply being with the presence of God. And the worry and the anxiety looked like a much more safe path. For some of you, there's other areas of just control and security, whether it's financially or personally or keeping everything together, that you just decided that this is way more attractive than the presence of God because I don't know if I can trust this presence over here. For some of you, people have let you down and you equated that with God, and so you've just assumed God's presence can't be trusted. And so you stopped longing for the presence. But what God's saying to you today is, hey, I will have compassion on who I'll have compassion. And if you turn to me, I will show you everything that I am. And I will illuminate your life in such a way that you will no longer be common, but you will be extraordinary. Would you bow your head and close your eyes? This morning, I want you to know that the presence of God is here. Whether you are aware of it or not, it is here in this place. It has been with you since you got up this morning. It has been following you in your car. It has been present with you. And just right now in this moment, I want you to pause. I want you to just take a minute and allow yourself to connect to the presence of God. I want you just to ask him to come, to speak to you. To move in you. To be still. God, would you give us the realization that David had? Not just a knowledge, but the realization that one day in your presence with the fullness of you is better than 1,000 elsewhere. God, that just to connect to your face, to your glory, is everything. And Lord, would you create in us the same stubbornness that Moses had? That we would refuse to move forward, we would refuse to continue on without your presence with us. This week, as we go, as we make decisions, as we enter into relationships, as we go about our careers and our lives, with our loved ones and our children, Father, would we continue to choose your presence moving with us over anything else? Would you teach us your ways and remember that we are your children We are grateful for your compassion, and we thank you in Jesus' name.
Thanks for listening to this week's talk. Join us next week for a new conversation or download the Humanity Church app to continue interacting with the community at Humanity. Thanks, and have a great week.